Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Back on the show is Bob Stefanowski, the Republican candidate for governor. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. It's a lot of drama going on, Bob. What's happening with the Independent Party? What in the world happened?
Well, listen, you know, one of the things I think people struggle with is the fairness of politics. And there is a line called the Independent Party of Connecticut. I was the endorsed candidate last time. They had a caucus the other night where even the chairman of the Independent Party has admitted he broke the rules. And we're looking into it. I mean, it was a couple pretty egregious things, Melissa. There were three people that were running for governor. Two people were listed on the ballot, and I wasn't. So people had to go to the trouble to write my name in, where the other two were already there. The chairman of the party voted two times for his candidate. Given all that, the vote still came out as a tie. So we're looking into it. You know, it's not about me so much, Melissa. I'm not going to say it's not a little bit about me. There were a lot of people. There are people that came down from Litchfield. They drove 2.5 hours to be at that event. There was a woman who it was her birthday that night. She took it off to come vote at that event. And these people, all Independent Party members, not just the chairman, they have a right. They all have one vote. And in our opinion, the chairman overruled the popular vote, which went for me. And I owe it to those people to look into it.
So what does that mean, looking into it? Because as you just mentioned, Bob, a couple of kind of red flags in that story, you know, to me, doesn't that alone, especially if you're saying the chair already admitted that he may have come up short, doesn't that immediately mean that, OK, we need to go back and recount or do this again? Like, I'm surprised we have to use legal action if there's already fault that's been admitted.
You would think, Melissa, we're going to go. The first up is the Secretary of State. I hope that it's he now. I hope that he sees it. I mean, this is not even questionable. This is blatant. And even the chairman of the Independent Party admitted he broke his bylaws. So you would hope that they would immediately act on it. That's my anticipation. If they don't, we'll see what our recourse is after that. You know, a lot of times politics gets involved here. The Democrats, you know, Governor Lamont doesn't want me on that line. I got a lot of votes on that line last time around. And there were multiple Democratic operatives in this caucus that were helping the Independent Party, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. They could do whatever they want. But everybody that shows up should get one vote. And the person who has more votes should win. And I had more votes than the opponent. So I owe it to those people to look into it. And hopefully we get the right result from the Secretary of State.
So, Bob, let's actually talk on an even broader scale, which is voter fraud. It's a huge issue, specifically in Bridgeport. We actually have a few pending situations right now, just right now in Bridgeport. And that's not to even include past years where we've had some really serious issues of voter fraud. You've got Senator Dennis Bradley, where there's some fraud going on with his past campaign. We've got one of the districts where an incumbent was beat at first, but then the recount showed that he wasn't, and it was in there are missing ballots. So we're having some real issues in Bridgeport, which I'm sure you're hearing about. What would you want to do? If you entered office, what would you do about the voter fraud, the ballot issue situations? Like, what do we do to combat this problem?
Well, first of all, we should be providing as much flexibility for people that can legitimately vote as we should. And we should make it as easy as possible. So I'm not against absentee ballots. I'm not against early voting. But before we do that, number one, we have to make sure the voter rolls are correct. When the Secretary of State in COVID sent out applications for absentee ballots, how many people do you know or your listeners know, Melissa, where they got an application for their son who moved to, you know, Florida 5 years ago? And there were, I think, about 200,000 of those applications that went back to the Secretary of State, said return to sender. And they refused to update the voter rolls for it. And you know why? It's because more Democrats vote absentee than Republicans. So we have to get the voter rolls right. I think we should have signature verification to make sure that the person who's saying who they are is who they are. And then once we tighten that up, we can provide as much flexibility as possible. But right now, there's too much opportunity for bad things to happen, and we need to tighten that up first.
But even like monitors, Bob, who run like the polling centers and stuff, have come into question. And if they are counting correctly, or if there are, you know, missing ballots, or if things are being counted twice, like, you know, does it come down to also just the authenticity of the people who are running our polling places?
Well, I think in Bridgeport, it's very heavily Democrat state. I think it'd be helpful, not just Republicans, but independents or working families parties. There should be a broader diversity of people. And it's not so much poll watching, it's poll working. Who's standing behind that person when they walk in and their name is crossed off the line? I think we need more independent verification. We need more visibility. It needs to be more of a bipartisan, if you want to talk Bridgeport specifically, it needs to be more of a bipartisan process, more of an independent process. And, you know, we're only trying to get to the right answer here. I mean, I've condemned what happened on January 6th. Joe Biden is the elected president of the United States. This is not like about a witch hunt like others have gone after. This is about just getting the right answer, because the people who vote deserve that. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it's about.
Bob Stefanowski is here, the Republican candidate for governor. And Bob, today is the first day back to school for a few of our school districts. Three in particular going back today also have some new faces on campus, armed and unarmed guards, including here in Ansonia in our neck of the woods. What do you think about armed guards in schools and sort of this change that we're starting to see with some, not all, but some school districts across Connecticut?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think we should leave it to the local communities. I don't think teachers should be armed per se. They've got enough to do trying to educate our kids and teach them what they need to know. I do think we need security officers in schools that need it. And if the local community feels that they should be armed, that's up to them. But you look at how we protect other assets, you know, around the world, banks and jewelry stores and whatever, and you think about how precious kids are, safety has to come first. I also think, Melissa, we should look more at the physical security of buildings. When you look at a lot of these issues, it's as simple a thing as leaving a door open in the back of the building. When I'm governor, one of the things I want to do is put some money towards allowing every community to inspect their schools. What can they do better? Forget about guards for a minute. Are there cameras? Do the doors all self-lock? I mean, we're sitting on a $5 billion budget surplus in our capital right now. Why wouldn't we use some of that money to make sure that every single school across our state has the security measures, the cameras, the self-locking doors that they need? I'd be doing that immediately. In fact, I would have done it 3 months ago, so it would have been done for the first day of school. I'm very surprised we haven't done that.
Well, and it's interesting because, Bob, I told a story a few months back. This was around the time that Uvalde happened, actually, that I had gone to speak at a school, at one of the charter schools in Bridgeport. And when I walked in, it was clear that the doors were all locked and that there were cameras in place. But it was interesting because I walked up, I pressed the button expecting to speak to someone on an intercom, and they just opened the door. And they didn't know who I was coming for. They didn't know who I was. Unless they could see on the cameras, like, I did have a bag with me, so they didn't know the contents in my bag. And it was just really surprising because I opened the door and I'm facing, you know, 20 kids in between classes just right then and there. And I'm like, it hit me there that I was like, wait a minute, we have things in place, but have we become so complacent thinking, okay, well, Connecticut's had their fair share of school shootings, so we're good. It's not going to happen again. Like, I think there's also some training that needs to be reinstilled as well.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you look at a typical bank, most don't have armed security guards, but they are secure, right? They've got cameras. And why wouldn't every school at least have the technology that a bank branch does? They're sitting on a lot of money, but who cares relative to the lives of kids? I'm going to do that day one, Melissa, when I'm in. I'm going to allocate money to it. We're going to help the communities. We're going to provide guidance on what the school should have to be top of security. And we should do an audit of every school to make sure that we should have done it 3 months ago before kids are showing up to school today. But as soon as I'm in and I control things, we're going to do it.
I mean, are there schools, we're talking to Bob Stefanowski this morning, the Republican candidate for governor, are there schools in Connecticut that either couldn't afford or don't have in place some of those security measures like cameras and automatic locked door systems and all that? Like, do we have schools in our state that are still not even up to par with those standards?
Absolutely, Melissa. I was talking to, and I won't tell you the town because it was confidential, but they are budgeted for, I think it was 60 security officers in schools, and they only had 30 because they didn't have the money to fill the other 30 positions. And I'm not making this story up. It came from a person in a big city. So again, here we are, $5 billion sitting in a bank account in the Capitol, and this school can't fill 30 open security positions? It's amazing that this stuff is happening. And I don't know how many schools there are throughout the state, grammar schools, middle schools, high school. I guarantee you that every one of those schools is not as secure as it could be. And we're going to be laser focused on making sure that happens.
Sounds good to me. Now, I'm curious with this, Bob, you know, talking about money, you know, something that is very controversial, just came on the news scene yesterday. The idea of taxpayer money now alleviating some of the college debt that Americans are still struggling with. You have some people who, of course, if they're the ones who are benefiting, are like, yes, this is awesome. But then you have a lot of people who are like, wait a minute, I did my time. I paid off my debt. I did my thing. Why am I covering other people's school debt? Where do you stand on this issue?
Well, there's certainly a fairness issue here. And you know, the person, and I got a friend who did it. He had three kids. He never took a vacation. He always bought used cars, and he got through without taking out any loans for his kids. Why should he be penalized for you know, doing the right thing? On the other hand, there are kids that can't afford school and they have loans. My issue, Melissa, is we should be providing jobs and a better environment and a better economy in Connecticut and higher paying jobs so that kids can pay it back itself. But nobody wants a kid to be in a lot of debt. The difference, in my humble opinion, between Governor Lamont and me is many Democrats want to create a sense of dependency. They want people to be reliant on them, so they vote for them again. My view is let's provide better jobs, let's help people have more take-home pay, and create a sense of independence so they're not reliant on a handout from Joe Biden in an election year deciding he needs to do something good to get reelected, and we all know that's what's happening. Now, if it helps some kids, that's fine, but it shouldn't be driven by politics. It should be driven by what's right for kids, what's right for their parents. Lower the cost of college education. Look at UConn. You know, you can't even go to UConn in an in-state tuition anymore.
No, it's
so
crazy.
Let's focus on the problem rather than handouts and avoiding the problem that really exists.
It is interesting you say that, Bob. I know I have a very good friend. I bring her up on this show a lot because I think the work that she does is amazing. But she's a social worker up in the Hartford area, and she doesn't get paid very well at all. Never did. But she's been living at home, you know, up until about a year ago. She had been living at home, and again, this is a friend of mine, so she's in her 30s, because she had to pay for student loan debt and so on and so forth. And what's awful is you come to this crossroads where you're like, okay, maybe I go to another job, another career that's not even connected to my industry just so I can make more money. But then now you're going down a path of like, but I'm miserable and I don't like what I did. And why did I pay for college to begin with if I'm not going to do what I went to school for? And I it's hard to disagree with, you know, why don't we just make jobs where you're actually getting paid for what you're doing, like actually get paid better and have better benefits and create more of an independence. That's very true. It's
hard to argue with that. You know, what about the trade schools? College education is great, but it's not for all kids. Kids coming out of these trade schools as electricians or carpenters, they've got five job offers and no student debt. So I'm not saying college is a bad thing, but our schools, it's almost like an ego thing. You have to go to Harvard. Who cares whether you go to Harvard?
Yeah.
A lot of kids are doing very well out of a 2-3 year trade school with no debt and great jobs. And we got to invest in our trade and our community colleges as well.
Yeah, it is very weird how we, like, as a society view trade schools and how we view, like, even community colleges. And I've always found that very, very bizarre how we look at it, because if it's not like a university or it doesn't have a Letterman jacket on it, it's just very weird how we look at that. I don't know. It's very, very odd. All right. Well, Bob Stefanowski, really appreciate you coming on, answering some of our questions this morning. I know we'll chat again in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much.
Great. I love coming on, Melissa. You're very fair. You're tough but fair, which is what I like. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate it. And I know we'll chat again in a couple of weeks. That is Bob Stefanowski, the Republican candidate for governor here on WICC. Good morning. We talk about cancer patients pretty often. Here at WICC, we do a lot of partnership work to try and help, for example, Swim Across the Sound. It's something we feel very strongly about. Because, look, cancer touches everyone, whether you, God forbid, have had or you are going through a cancer treatment right now. Maybe a family member, a friend, a colleague, or you heard of a story that just broke you because cancer is just pure evil. It's just awful. There was a new study, actually, Gates Foundation cancer study, that suggests that alcohol and smoking can cause almost half of the global cancer deaths out there. And the part of this that really concerned me was alcohol. Because smoking, you know, I think we all can really sort of expect that. But we live in a society where if you're not drinking alcohol, you must be pregnant or you must be an addict or something. Like, I'd say the majority of people expect you to be drinking at any social event or even at dinner or whatever the case may be. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about this study with a very familiar voice to our audience, and that is Dr. Charles Cha, who's with the Cancer Institute at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Good morning, Dr. Cha. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's dive into this study, first of all. Give us more of the specifics and help me to understand exactly what it's talking about.
Sure. So this was a study, as you mentioned, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And essentially, they took a study of all the studies available in all of the international literature, and they coalesced it into categorizing risk factors and how much of these risk factors impacted actual deaths from cancer. And what was sort of very surprising was the high percentage, as you mentioned, of the deaths that were attributable to preventable causes, as opposed to what we generally think of in terms of cancer as it being sort of something that we can't control or something that is genetic, with almost half of these cases being attributable to preventable causes.
So how many people did they look at in this study? Do you have those facts?
Well, it's hard to really say how many, because what they did is they took a study of all the studies that are available, and they took a very comprehensive approach. So there are thousands of studies that they analyzed, which individually probably had many thousands of patients themselves. So I don't think they even estimated how many patients they looked at, but it is what they consider and what most people consider the most comprehensive analysis globally of cancer risk.
So when you hear about, like I said, I think smoking is kind of a no-brainer. Anytime you decide to, you know, use drugs, I feel like, you know, I think society in general knows, like, you know, because I have colleagues here that I work with, Dr. Cha, who oftentimes will say, like, oh, I'm just having my cancer stick for the day. I mean, they're very aware that when they're smoking cigarettes or whatever it may be, that this is that it could cause cancer. But alcohol, I think that's the one that really, I don't think people really realize what a danger it can be to them. You know, what's specific about alcohol that could cause cancer?
Yeah, in this study, as you mentioned, smoking, alcohol, and a third of the sort of top three is being overweight, believe it or not, are all what we would consider preventable cancer risk.
Right.
But I think we have to be careful about sort of pointing the finger too much at individual patients, because these are things that I think are societal problems and also are, from a governmental standpoint, something that we need to focus on at a broader sort of local or even national level. Because we see over the past, say, multiple decades that smoking rates have come down. And I think that that's from the smoking prevention sort of overall global programs that exist. And alcohol, I agree. It's something that from a social standpoint is quite acceptable. I think we also have to remember that how much you drink also affects your cancer risk. There are some studies that suggest even as little as 1 to 2 drinks per day will increase, say, a woman's risk of breast cancer. But to really increase your risk of liver cancer, which is another type of cancer that you can get from alcohol, you really have to be somebody who really is abusing alcohol. And then there's other things such as esophageal cancer that maybe might be more moderate. But essentially, any type of alcohol intake is going to increase your risk for cancer. What concerns me also is that there's many patients who have all three of the top three, which is they smoke, they drink, and they're overweight, and that just really incrementally increases your risk for many types of cancer like esophageal, liver, pancreas, gallbladder. There's a number of different cancers that are going to be increased, particularly if you have all three of those. And number four is air pollution. So that's something that we can't control. And again, from a governmental standpoint, that's something that globally needs to be focused on a bit more, particularly in more industrialized nations.
So, Dr. Chaw, I mean, you just outlined some things that we could do to prevent cancer, like staying on top of our weight or, you know, not smoking and not drinking alcohol. But, you know, going back to the preventable, I think sometimes we, you know, we sort of say, you know, could cause cancer, like in the background. Like, I think we've become so immune to that phrase that it doesn't have as much weight as it should unless you're somebody who is directly connected to cancer, which is terrible. But, you know, I think, you know, talking about things like even, you know, even weight loss, but I really want to focus on the alcohol because I think that has become such a societal norm that the majority of people are going to be drinking at a social event or at a casual dining experience. And the person who's not drinking is looked at like they've got 6 heads. That's like what it is today. And I know you're laughing because you know it's true. And so I guess, what do we do to change that societal outlook? Whether it's cancer or whether it's just in general trying to live the longest and healthiest life you can, how do we change the perspective on alcohol?
Yeah, I think you bring up a very good point. I think it is sort of more of a societal issue that I don't know if any one individual can address individually other than to try to live as healthy and as, from treating the body as if it is that temple that you need to really make sure from a nutritional standpoint and from an alcohol standpoint, you're doing everything you can to keep it as fit and as tuned up as possible, because a lot of these injuries that eventually lead to cancer is not a one-time hit. It is a multiple hit process over the course of many, many years. And also, as a person who sees cancer patients every day and treats cancer patients on a daily basis, this study also is a little bit shocking to me in terms of how high of a percent of patients have preventable risk factors. I'm very used to talking to my patients and telling them that, really the vast majority of the cause of whatever type of cancer that they have is really unknown. And really what the study, it changes our mindset a little bit to think, well, actually, maybe that's not true. I think there probably is a genetic component, and there are probably some environmental components that we can't control, but there are a definite almost half of cases that are potentially preventable. Now, does that mean that it's something that we can just kind of turn a switch off and then all of a sudden all these cancers will go away? I don't think so, because it's a lifelong exposure to these environmental factors or to smoking or to drinking that lead to this. But I think it's something that we can then attack and try to reduce and hopefully bring down those numbers of cancer patients overall.
Well, Dr. Charles Chaw of the Cancer Institute of St. Vincent's Medical Center, I really appreciate having you come on this morning to talk more about this. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, if you want to learn more, head over to HartfordHealthcare.org/cancer.
Let's get wild. It's the Zoo Minute with Greg Dancho from Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo on Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Hello there, Greg Dancho. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I can't complain. I'm really excited to talk about the Conservation Discovery Corps because it's something that I'm hoping, of course, I won't press anything on my son, but I'm hoping, you know, someday when he's a little bit older, it's something he'd be interested in. I think this is such a cool program. How long has it been around before we dive into what exactly it is?
It's been over 7-8 years now that the program has been involved, and we're really excited about it. It's one of the programs that, you know, when I mentioned this before, when I first started working here at the zoo back in 75, I was a volunteer, and I came to the facility and asked the director at that point, you know, what volunteer opportunities were available, and there really wasn't any. And kind of had to make my own way through that. And so to have a program like this right now, I wish we had this program when I was a youngster, because I feel this is one of the most important things that we do here at Connecticut's Beardsley Zoo is work with students and get them interested and excited into the conservation and environmental field. And this program is geared toward high school students. We do have a 4-H program, a Zoo Explorer program, which is a scouting program, and then the CDC program, which is Conservation Discovery Corps. And that program starts, you know, you can start that program anytime in high school, but really if we get the students in as freshmen, we can keep them there for 4 years throughout their tenure in high school. And then at the end of this program, they can have a tremendous boost in when they're looking for colleges to go to or universities to go to, when they put their resumes together and applications together on stuff that they've done here at the zoo. And it's, to me, it's so exciting to have these students be able to do the things they do. And some of the things they did this year, you know, they were, like you said, there was 33 students. They did about 547 hours of work out
in
the
amazing.
Field.
Like, that's amazing. Where was this program when I went to Laurelton? Because you're required to do also service work at Laurelton. And you know, and not that I didn't enjoy where I did my service work, but man, like, I would have just wanted to go above and beyond. Like, over 500 hours of work this summer, but it all sounded so, like, amazing. I don't know. It's just incredible.
I would have been excited to do any of this stuff.
Yeah, me too.
You know,
me too.
They went out and tagged horseshoe crabs. They tagged 44 horseshoe crabs with Sacred Heart University and their program, Luminous, with the horseshoe crab program they're studying out in Long Island Sound. They went out and they banded 600 Canada geese, in collaboration with DEEP. They're out there with nets when the geese go into an eclipse plumage. Right, they can't fly anymore, so they basically herd them up and catch them in nets and then band them. And this way, they can study the migratory habits and what's going on with the Canada geese in Connecticut, which a lot of people think about all the time, especially when they're on the lawns and how what you know sometimes the beauty of them and also the damage they do. Mm-hmm. They went through and over 1,200 pounds of trash in Beardsley Park doing river cleanups. They went out and planted 4,000 seagrass plugs in the salt marsh in Stratford, working with Stratford on a salt marsh restoration program, again, with DEEP and the Stratford Conservation Commission. They removed invasive plants in Milford Beach. One of the cool things also, they constructed 2 cement oyster reef balls as part of the program to create artificial reefs in Connecticut along the shoreline.
That's so cool.
They're doing scuba diving lessons now. That's off site, which is the exciting things. But here, even on ground, if people our guests were able to see them this summer, they wear blue shirts which has the CDC logo on the back. And on grounds, they built enrichment for our giant anteaters. They removed invasive plants on zoo grounds. They assisted with the Sky Hunter show that we've been having here on the weekends with the raptors.
Yes, sure. And
again, which is cool, you mentioned this before, they also helped monitor the brook trout and helped with the release with the fish in the classroom program that we do with the other school systems. And again, one of the big things I get for them is that they interact with our guests and interact with the people visiting here and give the information that they learn. This is a program where they actually come in and sit in a classroom, and really it's a classroom situation where they learn all this stuff that they're going to do and then go out and actually do it, which, again, how cool is that?
It really is so cool. Now, my question for this, Greg, 33 students, like how many do you typically have per summer? And I'd imagine this is pretty competitive.
It is very competitive. We do have in the fall, and again, keep an eye on our website when the next classes will start. Right now, in my head, I'm not remembering what they are, but keep a look on our website. We do them in the winter time when they get the classroom situation, and that way they're ready for the spring. And we take up to 45 students. I believe that's the case. 45 students. These are from all around the region. These are from the Bridgeport area, also stretching out, around in the Fairfield County and New Haven County. Kids that are interested in the field. And again, what we're trying to do here is give them a taste of what it's like in the conservation and environmental arena. And that way, if this is something they want to pursue going forward, when they go to college, go to the university, this is some way they can know whether or not this is something that's going to interest them, which I think is a great thing for them also to get a little bit of a taste of what it's like. We also now, because the program has been going for a long time, we've been able to track some of the students that left us, and we've had some students now working in zoos around the country, which again, to me, that's just
that must make you like a
just
proud
tremendous.
Papa. That must be it, so
it's
cool.
It's just nice because again, it's I think I mentioned it before on the show, the starfish or a sea star analogy, parable, whatever it is, where you throw the sea star in the water and there's lots of them on the beach and you hope that, they make it. And this is one of the things when you know that somebody went out there and started here and now are working in the field that I love so much, that it's really, really cool.
It is so special.
I'm excited.
So, Greg, last question before I let you go. How can people, start to get their applications? And what do they do? Do they go to the website, all the details there?
Keep an eye on the website and our Facebook page. Our CDC will put out the application, put out the notice. Again, we start, I believe, in the winter time with this, so keep an eye out for that, and they'll be looking for the next class for starting next year. So keep an eye out there, and I'll make sure that the Facebook pages keep up to date on that. The other thing is that we also started selling tickets for our Glow Wild program, our fall. I'm getting ahead of myself.
It's one of the four seasons. You knocked out three of them, so it's somewhere in there.
Summer went by so quickly. It was a blur. Our Glow Wild program, which is going to be our night light show, is starting in September, end of September, and we're running through just before Thanksgiving. It'll be an evening event, and we have over 60 large animal light up program. It's going to be just tremendous. Get a ticket. Take a look on our website for that. We're selling tickets now, and we're excited about having this program run as kind of the accumulation of our 100th year anniversary.
We're really excited too. I got the email about it actually earlier this week with our membership, and Chase immediately was like, "When are we booking it?" I said, "Well, we have to find a weekend that I know for sure we can go and we can really enjoy it. And that if we're out a little late, it's okay." But that's really neat. And of course, if you want to check that out and everything else at the Beardsley Zoo, make sure you go to beardsleyzoo.org. And of course, just go to the Beardsley Zoo. It's right here in Bridgeport, Connecticut.
One last thing before I, is that we talked last week about the invasive animals and the lanternfly. So guess what? I was with my wife having breakfast in a restaurant in Milford. Mm-hmm. I looked up on the post, and one of the lanternflies landed right in front of my face.
Oh, did you kill it?
He is no more.
He is no longer with us. You did your job as a citizen of Connecticut.
And then I made sure that I contacted Deep, which is on the website. Good. And they got right back to me and said, again, this is something that they're really interested for people to get involved with. So, again, it was something in action.
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, thank you for the reminder. Certainly really important. And, Greg, always appreciate having you on every week for Zoom Minute. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too. That's Greg Danto of the Beardsley Zoo right here on WICC.